Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we continue now with the final part of Sutta number 117 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Mahachatarisaka Sutta, the discourse on the Great 40. And I said when I was introducing this sutta that it seemed to me that this sutta has been based upon an older version of a sutta which has been somewhat remodeled or reformulated in the light of developments that are taking place within early Buddhism, the evolution of Buddhist thought in the direction of Abhidharma. Now, just before we get into the sutta itself, I want to show you, read to you some passages from a work of the Abhidharma Pitaka called the Vibhanga. This is the second book of the Abhidharma Pitaka, the Theravada, the Pali Abhidharma Pitaka. The title Vibhanga means Book of Analysis. And this work, the Vibhanga, has a chapter which is called Magga Vibhanga, which means the analysis of the path. And actually, many of the chapters of the Vibhanga have two sections, actually even three sections, but the two main sections are analysis according to the suttas and analysis according to the Abhidhamma. So in the Vibhanga we have chapters on the five aggregates, the six sense bases, the elements, the faculties, four noble truths, dependent origination, then four foundations of mindfulness, seven enlightenment factors, the great efforts, the right efforts, and so on. And each of these chapters has two subdivisions, sometimes three subdivisions. The two main subdivisions are the analysis according to the suttas and analysis according to the Abhidhamma method, the special method of the Abhidhamma. And now, one of the chapters in the Vibhanga, as I said, chapter 11, is called Magga Vibhanga, which means analysis of the path. And again, in this chapter, we find these two sections, the Sutta section and the technical Abhidhamma section. And now in the Sutta section, one that begins, I translate, the Noble Eightfold Path, that is to say, right view and so on up to right concentration. Therein, what is right view? Knowledge of suffering, knowledge of the origin of suffering, knowledge of the cessation of suffering, knowledge of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. And each of the other path factors is defined exactly as one finds them defined in the suttas. For example, in Majjhima Nikaya, in Sutta number 141, one gets the definition of each of the past sections. Right through to the definition of right concentration, samasamadhi, in terms of the four jhanas. Okay, so this is the sutta analysis. Then comes another section. The second section is called Abhidhamma analysis. It begins, eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right livelihood, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Okay, therein, what is right view? Okay, whatever is wisdom, understanding, faculty of wisdom, power of wisdom, then a whole series of other terms, synonyms for wisdom, non-delusion, the investigation of phenomena, right view, the investigation of phenomena, enlightenment factor, the path factor, which is included within the path, this is called right view. So it's very similar to the definition that we find in this discourse on the Great 40. Except that here, this definition is now picked up many more synonyms for wisdom. In fact, this text is abridged because it's based on the first book of the Abhidhamma Pitaka, which has a list of maybe about 20 synonyms for right view or wisdom. Okay, next, what is right intention? That which is thought, thinking, intention, absorption, fixation, directing of the mind, right, the path factor of right intention that is included within the path, this is called right intention. And similarly, what is right speech? that I could translate exactly the way the terms are used here. Would be the desisting from the four kinds of verbal misconduct, the abstaining, refraining, abstinence from them, not doing of them, non-doing of them, non-committing of them, not transgressing of them, the breaking of the bridge, right speech, which is a path factor included within the path, this is called right speech. And similarly, very similar definitions for right action, right livelihood. And so the definitions here in the Vibhanga, a book of the Abhidhamma Pitaka, you could see almost identical, a little bit more elaborate than the definitions that one finds in this discourse on the Great 40. And so it seems that this particular section of the Vibhanga could well have been based upon the discourse of the Great 40 and represents a further elaboration of it. Or it could be the case that even that this particular section of the Vibhanga was already beginning to take shape at a certain period, And then this type of definition was then worked back into the older version of the sutta in order to create this double layering of the path factors, the mundane and super mundane. Okay, now last time we finished going through each of the explanations of each of the five path factors, and notice, and this is the important point, that when each of the five path factors is defined, we find an additional paragraph in which right effort and right mindfulness are brought in. Here, right effort is explained as the effort to abandon the particular wrong counterpart of that path factor and to enter upon or to acquire the right version, the right manifestation of that particular path factor. And mindfulness would be the quality of, you say, awareness, attentiveness, through which one abandons the wrong version of the path factor and enters upon and dwells in the right version of the path factor. And so when one takes all five path factors that are defined and sees that each of them are conjoined with right effort and right mindfulness, and not only that, but each of them is also preceded by right view. Even though right view is one of the path factors that is defined, but right view plays a kind of double role. On the one hand, it is one of the path factors to be defined. On the other, right view is one of the, you could call it the constant path factors, one of those factors which accompanies and it both precedes and accompanies the other five factors, including itself, because right view plays the role of the forerunner. It precedes in that it distinguishes what is right and what is wrong, what is proper, what is improper, in this domain of views, intentions, speech, action, and livelihood. So it's the forerunner, and right view will also accompany each of these path factors. Okay, so far we've explored this now, so we've finish this study of the five path factors through right livelihood. The text doesn't go on to give separate definitions of right mindfulness, of right effort and right mindfulness. And right concentration was mentioned so far only at the beginning, but in a sense, right concentration is the theme of the whole sutta. Since the sutta begins by the Buddha saying, I will teach you noble right concentration with its supports and its requisites. And so the explanation of the other path factors is undertaken in order to clarify the nature of this noble right concentration. And yet it's a little strange that the Buddha has not come back to right concentration at the end and shown how all the other factors contribute to right concentration. That seems to be left implicit. But now we come in paragraph 34, we're going to see how the sutta gets its name, the Great 40. And we begin again with the statement that right view comes first. And then we get the sequence, how does right view come first? In one of right view, right intention comes into being. In one of right intention, right speech comes into being. In one of right speech, right action comes into being. And so on. In one of right action, right livelihood comes into being. And so on, and so on, and so on. Okay, I'll take this right through up to the point. In one of right mindfulness, right concentration comes into being, on page 939. And now I want to go back and now trace how this will work in practical terms. And so we take right view comes first. And the commentary will say that this refers entirely to the supramundane path factors. But I think that's taking too limited a view of this sequence. I think it can also be understood to apply at the ordinary or mundane level. And I would see it in this way. Okay, we have right view comes first. And what is right view? We have two kinds of right view, two levels of right view. First, there is what is called the right view that partakes of merit, the right view that's connected with the taints, with the influxes. This is the right view of, we call it the right view of moral causation, or the right view of karma and its fruit, the right view that actions, morally significant actions, have consequences. Now there's another important formulation of right view, which is not mentioned in the sutta, but it comes repeatedly whenever in many other suttas when the Buddha defines right view. And that is the definition of right view as knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. Knowledge of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, the way to the cessation of suffering. It's an interesting question. Why isn't the definition of right view in terms of the Four Noble Truths mentioned in this sutta explicitly? Anybody have any idea about this? Not an easy question. Take a guess. Nobody wants to try again? You want to try? For those three. Yeah. Yeah. It's true that they'll have knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, but why shouldn't it be mentioned in the definition of right view in this sutta? Okay. Okay, this is the way I would understand it or explain it. Okay, here we're distinguishing two kinds of right view. This, what I would call the mundane right view and the super mundane. Now, one can't make the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths the mundane right view, because it is also the content, the objective content of the super mundane right view. When the person develops insight, when that insight reaches maturity and becomes wisdom, and then when it attains the super mundane wisdom, what that wisdom penetrates and realizes is the Four Noble Truths. Especially it's the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, which brings a comprehensive understanding of all Four Noble Truths. And yet, it seems two reasons why one can't make the Four Noble Truths the definition of supramundane right view. According to the method of this sutta, all of the supramundane path factors, as I said last time, they're all being defined and explained psychologically in terms of mental content rather than in terms of their objective content. And so when they define supramundane right view, they define it in terms of various synonyms for wisdom, understanding, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, and so on. So one doesn't give a definition in terms of the content. That's one reason. Another reason would be if one defines supramundane right view in terms of the Four Noble Truths, then it seems one is putting the Four Noble Truths entirely in the supramundane compartment, and then it has no extension into mundane right view. But when we start out on the Buddha's path, following the path to liberation, rather than just the mundane path that leads to higher rebirth, then one has to start with a conceptual right understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So this is not yet a super mundane wisdom, it's a mundane wisdom, or mundane right view. And yet, that same content, that same subject or theme, also becomes the content of the super mundane right view. So we could say the Four Noble Truths, somewhat like a bridge which has its base upon the two sides of the river. Part of the Four Noble Truths are in the mundane dimension, part in the supramundane dimension. And it's by understanding the mundane aspects of the Four Noble Truths deeper and deeper and deeper that one eventually comes to the supramundane, the liberative aspect. This is my interpretation. This is not explained in any commentary, none that I have seen. Okay, so we have right view coming first. We have these two aspects of right view, which I want to put here as right view of karma causation and right view of the Four Noble Truths. And now from right view, right intention arises. Does anybody remember the expanded definition of right intention? Again, we have it in Sutta number 141. Actually, we have it in this sutta too, at Monday. I'm sorry, leading you up the garden path. We have it strangely here as the right intentions that are partaking of merit connected with the taint. In paragraph 13 we have it. Intention of renunciation, intention of non-ill will, intention of non-cruelty. Let's see if we can draw some connection between right view and right intention. How these two types of right view might give rise to these three types of right intention. Any suggestions? Any connections between them? First, let's take the right view of the karmic causation. See if we can draw a connection between that and the arising of right intention. Okay, so the right view of karma causation, because the person who considers the law of karma causation will realize that any kind of harm, suffering inflicted upon others will come back upon himself, come back upon herself. And so one will therefore be hesitant to even give rise to intentions of harming, cruelty, or ill will. And this gets expressed in we have the 10 courses of wholesome action, and one of them is non-ill will. But also, I think this is also my supposition that also the understanding of karmic causation will also put a check on the stronger types of greed and desire, those types which will be considered unlawful, improper, immoral, that one would want to control one's desires that they don't become, don't overstep the bounds of proper ethics. But by itself, the right view of karma causation is not sufficient to lead to this attitude or intention of complete detachment or non-attachment and renunciation. That would come through the understanding of the Four Noble Truths, understanding how craving gives rise to dukkha, to suffering and to bondage. When that understanding arises and develops, then it leads to a turning away from craving. Okay, then the text continues, right intention gives rise to right speech, and right speech gives rise to right action. Right action gives rise to right livelihood. This, I have to say, I would not take too literally. That is, I would not take too literally the idea that right speech gives rise to right action, right action to right livelihood, but more, I think, it's stated in this way in order to maintain the pattern of the exposition. But really, apart from that pattern, what takes place is that right intention gives rise simultaneously to right speech, right action, right livelihood. Those three ethical factors really arise simultaneously, or ideally they should arise simultaneously. In different individuals, there might be a stress on one rather than another, but the three have basically the same relationship to right intention, and right intention is what lies behind each of them, rather than right speech being the strong cause for right action, that I can see, and right action for right livelihood. And I think it's not so difficult to see how right intention will give rise, let us say, to right speech at the mundane level. Most lying, false speech, at least the worst kinds, will be motivated either by hatred and cruelty, or else by strong greed. So when one is controlling greed and ill will, then the natural inclination will be not to speak falsely. And malicious speech, divisive speech, generally motivated by ill will and cruelty. Harsh speech, motivated by ill will. Idle chatter, little bit of greed, a little bit of ill will, but more it's just other things in the mind. It's not so much greed and ill will, but just restlessness of the mind that lies behind idle chatter. Restless, roaming interest. The need to keep the mind preoccupied. So it takes much more work to overcome idle chatter than the other three. Okay, non-killing. Of course, killing is usually motivated by hatred, occasionally by strong greed, when somebody kills in order to steal. And then stealing, of course, by greed, sexual misconduct by greed, sometimes by hatred. So, when one has developed right intention, the three types of wrong action are controlled, and the right intention will express itself in right action. And right intention will also motivate one to choose a proper livelihood, a kind of livelihood which does not cause any harm to others, a type of livelihood which can be beneficial and helpful to others. Okay, now the text goes on, in one of right livelihood, right effort comes into being. So it seems, the text seems to be saying here that right effort arises through right livelihood. But now this is an interesting point, and then right mindfulness from right effort. But this is an interesting point. If you remember the explanation of the five path factors that were analyzed previously, in the case of each one, it says that one makes an effort to abandon the wrong factor and to acquire the right factor. And one abandons the wrong factor mindfully, one acquires, one enters upon and dwells in the right factor mindfully. So in fact, even though right effort and right mindfulness come to prominence later on, in fact, right effort and right mindfulness were already operating from the very time right view came into being. But now, with the establishment of right speech, right action, right livelihood, there's now a very secure basis, foundation for the strengthening of right effort. And now the role of right effort at this, call this this higher level, is going to be the effort towards the development, the effort towards the development of right concentration. And so the effort now becomes, we have the classical definition of the fourfold right effort. That is the effort to prevent the arising of, you don't have to copy this down, just look at sutta number 141. But the effort to prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome states, the effort to the effort to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. This refers particularly to overcoming the five mental hindrances. Those are the hindrances, the main obstacles to samadhi, to concentration. Sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and remorse and doubt, then the effort to generate, to produce, to develop the wholesome mental qualities, particularly here the seven factors of enlightenment, or to cultivate the four foundations of mindfulness. And then the effort to fulfill and bring to completeness, the fullness of development, the wholesome factors that have already arisen. Okay, and so I said right effort is now at this point is dedicated to the obtaining right concentration, and the way right effort moves towards right concentration is through the systematic development of right mindfulness. Okay, so right effort at this point is applied to developing the four satipatthanas, the four, what's called the four foundations of mindfulness, the four establishments of mindfulness. That is the mindful contemplation, mindful observation of the body, feelings, mental states, and phenomena. And right mindfulness developed in one way, in one mode, leads to increasing concentration, culminating in right concentration, which is defined, the standard definition is the four jhanas. But in my opinion, when right concentration is defined as the four jhanas, it does not mean that in order to develop insight, one first has to attain the jhanas, or to even to reach the first two stages of enlightenment, that one has to attain the jhanas. But I think this is the use of a kind of formula to show the ideal form of concentration, is the jhana concentration. But as I understand the method of the suttas, one can use a lower level of concentration as a basis for developing insight. As insight knowledge matures, it will provide a basis for strengthening of concentration, and then at a certain point it will be sufficient with a moderate degree of concentration and very sharp insight to reach the supramundane attainment, at least up to the first two, stage of stream entry, stage of once returner. The stage of non-returner, it seems that jhana becomes necessary at that point. So maybe not, I'm not so sure. Okay, but now when right concentration is achieved, one now has, this is still a mundane, it's still a mundane right concentration. But it is a mundane concentration because it's based upon right view, including the right view of the Four Noble Truths. It's a concentration directed towards liberation. And then one uses that right concentration as a basis for investigation, investigating the nature of phenomena with mindfulness. And now one attends mindfully to phenomena in such a way that one is now discerning their distinct characteristics, qualities, conditional relations. And so mindfulness working in conjunction with this concentration, the mindfulness occurring within the concentrated mind, is serving as the instrument for the arising of insight. This will be insight wisdom. And this becomes another level of right view. This is no longer just a conceptual right view, but based on this concentration, there is arising what is called the vipassana samadhi, the right view of insight. And insight is directed towards uncovering, discerning, perceiving, the three characteristics of all conditioned phenomena. That is, the impermanence of all conditioned phenomena, the unsatisfactory nature, the imperfect nature, the defective nature of all conditioned phenomena. This is the characteristic of dukkha. And then the selfless nature, the emptiness of any kind of substantial selfhood in any and all phenomena. And then when insight knowledge, when it reaches its culmination, when this discernment of the three characteristics reaches the very, you might call the rock bottom of the nature of phenomena, and all of the other faculties are mature, then there arises the supramundane path, or world-transcending path, which is just an instant, I call it an instantaneous experience. But I'm leaving aside the question, this is the big dispute between the Theravada and Sarvastivada. Is it one mind moment, or is it 16 mind moments? I don't know. And it's a pretty academic question. But when I use the expression instantaneous, it could be interpreted in either way, whatever school one prefers. Now, the supramundane path is a state of samadhi. This is a samadhi. It is the right concentration. And it is, in fact, not simply right concentration, it is the Arya Sama Samadhi, the noble right concentration. And in that state of samadhi, all eight path factors are present simultaneously. Each of them has its own job to do within that instantaneous experience. An experience of a sudden breakthrough to the supramundane. What takes place on that occasion of the supramundane is that the mind, which has been contemplating the three characteristics in conditioned phenomena, in sankharas, in bodily and mental phenomena, it drops all conditioned phenomena and penetrates, realizes the unconditioned, the deathless, nibbana. And in that samadhi, the right view plays a very important role, much more so than in ordinary mundane samadhi, which is mundane samadhi. The strong factor is that of one-pointedness of mind. But in the supramundane samadhi, there is the one-pointedness of mind joined together with this wisdom that is understanding the unconditioned truth. And also cutting off, that wisdom is cutting off permanently certain layers of ignorance and defilements that are connected, rooted in that ignorance. Okay, that takes us through right concentration comes into being. Now we're back onto page 939. In one of right concentration, right knowledge comes into being. In one of right knowledge, right deliverance, or I would prefer now, right liberation comes into being. Okay, now we have here, in addition to the normal eight factors of the path, two other factors are mentioned. Right knowledge, this is sama jnana, and right liberation, or right deliverance, sama vimutti. And here's an interesting variation. In the Pali, right knowledge comes before right liberation. But there's a Chinese version of the sutta and of the sequence in which right deliverance, right liberation, comes before right knowledge. That's correct? And interestingly, the commentary explains right knowledge as right reviewing knowledge, which implies that the right knowledge that arises here should actually be what reviewing means is reviewing of liberation. So this implies that right knowledge should really come after right liberation. What is this right knowledge? If you take a look, now we go to page sutta number 27 as an example. Let us get to page 277. The same stock passage that occurs about four or five times in the Majjhima Nikaya. I'm just taking this as one example. Page 277, paragraph 226. The Buddha has now traced the gradual training of the disciple who's now seeing the Four Noble Truths. That's described in paragraph 25. So in paragraph 26, it says, when he knows and sees thus, his mind is liberated from the taint or the influx of sensual desire, from the influx of craving for existence, from the influx or taint of ignorance. Liberated here is the verb vimucciti, which gives us the noun vimutti, liberation, deliverance. When it is liberated, vimutti, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. There comes jnana, it is liberated. He understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming to any state of being. Okay, so when the disciple undergoes or goes through this liberation of the mind from the taint or from the defilement, that is right deliverance, right liberation. And when that process of being liberated is complete, then a knowledge arises that looks into the mind, is able to fully examine the mind, and knows that the mind has been fully liberated from the defilement. That would be this right knowledge. Somehow the sequence got inverted from one... But the two factors came in one sequence in one tradition and a different sequence in the other tradition. Also, we sometimes have five aggregates of the liberated person. These are not the five aggregates, form, feeling, perception, but five, you could say them, five accomplishments of the liberated person. One is the accomplishment in virtue or moral discipline, then the accomplishment in concentration, the accomplishment in wisdom, the fourth then is accomplishment in liberation. The fifth is accomplishment in the knowledge and vision of liberation. That, it seems, that knowledge and vision of liberation, it seems, would be the same as this right knowledge. Okay, now we come to an important and interesting statement. And I would change the translation. I think it's not translated correctly here. It should say, thus, bhikkhus, the disciple in higher training on the path, not the path of the disciple, but the disciple in higher training on the path, possesses eight factors. The arahant possesses 10 factors. I've seen some writers on Buddhism say, besides the Noble Eightfold Path, there's also a Tenfold Path. Those who speak about the Noble Eightfold Path forget to mention that there's also on the path right knowledge and right liberation. But actually, right knowledge, right liberation are not factors of the path. On the path, there are eight factors. And when one completes the path, then one gets two extra qualities, right knowledge and right liberation. Those are special, unique endowments of the arahant, the liberated one. Any questions at this point? Okay, so now we'll go on to complete the sutta. Okay, now the Buddha again goes back to the beginning with the statement, right view comes first. And now, beginning with paragraph 35, this is going to give us the explanation of the title of the sutta, the Great 40. Okay, right view comes first. How does right view come first? In one of right view, wrong view is abolished, and the many evil, unwholesome states that originate with wrong view as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right view as condition come to fulfillment by development. Here it seems quite definitely that this is the right view of the supramundane path. Because if it speaks of abolishment and fulfillment by development. But we could see the process beginning even before that of abolishment, but even at the very beginning when one acquires right view, one is starting to wear away wrong view. And to wear away, to eliminate the unwholesome states that originate through wrong view. And then when right view comes to fulfillment, wrong view is eliminated, and the evil, unwholesome states that arise from wrong view, those are eliminated. And when one acquires right view, then even from the very beginning, when right view arises, then it brings along many other wholesome states. Right view is very, very important. Wrong view and right view. Many other wholesome states arise along with right view, conditioned by right view. They arise as right view is strengthened and matured. Those wholesome states become strengthened. And then when right view is fully ripened, then those wholesome states come to fulfillment by development. To emphasize the importance of wrong view and right view, in Anguttara Nikaya, there are some suttas where the Buddha says, I do not see even one single thing which is so harmful to living, to human beings, and which leads to the arising of other unwholesome states as wrong view. And I do not see any other thing which is so beneficial to human beings and which so much causes the arising of wholesome mental states as right view. So we might think wrong view, right view, that's just ideas and opinions, artificial quarreling about opinion, but in fact, wrong view and right view, it's very important to understand them correctly and to distinguish between them. Okay, so we have on one side in one column the 10 right factors, that's right view through right liberation. Those are the states to be developed, to be cultivated. And when they arise, then they bring along with them the states that are conditioned by each one. States conditioned by right view, states conditioned by right intention, all the way through to the states, the wholesome states, that arise with right deliverance as condition. And when these 10 right factors arise, they also eliminate or abolish the 10 corresponding wrong factors, all the ways from wrong view through wrong intention, wrong speech, down to wrong liberation. This might be what? Wrong liberation? Anybody grow up in the 1960s, America, 1960s? Yeah. Down with all regulations, rules, let us do what we want. Maybe that's one type only of wrong liberation. We could think of dozens of kinds of wrong liberation. And then each of these 10 wrong factors is also the condition for various unwholesome states. And so when they are eliminated, then the many unwholesome states that they condition, those are eliminated. And so we come in paragraph 36. There are 20 factors on the side of the wholesome, that's what I hear called the positive, and 20 factors on the side of the unwholesome. So this Dhamma discourse on the great 40 has been set rolling and cannot be stopped by any recluse or Brahmin or God or Mara or Brahma. or anyone in the world. Then paragraph 37, the Buddha says, if any recluse or Brahmin thinks that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censored and rejected, somebody wants to criticize and blame this discourse, then one can make 10 deductions from his statements that would be grounds for censoring him right here and now. That is, if this person is going to criticize the discourse on the Great 40, then he might be criticizing, censoring right view, and then he would be implicitly praising and honoring those recluses and Brahmins who hold wrong view. If he criticizes right intention, then he's honoring the recluses and Brahmins who have wrong intention, and so on. If he is criticizing right liberation, right deliverance, then he would be honoring and praising the hippie recluses and Brahmins who are, or any of the others, who are of wrong liberation. And then the Buddha says in paragraph 38, he refers, this statement is difficult for us to understand today. He says, even those teachers from Okkala, we don't really know where Okkala is, Vassa and Banya, and there's no, we don't have any information about them except what's said here, who held the doctrine of non-causality, the doctrine of non-doing, and the doctrine of nihilism, would not think that this Dhamma discourse on the Great 40 should be censored and rejected. Okay, these doctrines, three doctrines that the Buddha is referring to here, these are the three types of very strong, morally blameworthy wrong view. The doctrine of nihilism says that there is no result, no karmic results of good and bad actions, that when a person dies, everything is finished, and the person's actions don't produce any karmic consequences. The doctrine, what's called the doctrine of non-doing, this doctrine says that there's no validity to ethical distinctions between good and bad. So if a person, we find this doctrine stated in Sutta 76. We find all of them in Sutta 76. If a person goes around, the doctrine of non-doing is in paragraph 10, Sutta 76, paragraph 10. I won't read it all, just in brief. He'll say that if a person goes around, one person goes around with a razor-sharp knife, killing everyone in sight, just reducing them to heaps of flesh, he doesn't do anything evil. If another person goes along with many gifts, giving gifts in charity, benefiting others in many ways, he doesn't do anything meritorious. If there's no validity to distinctions between good and evil, merit and demerit, that they're just empty words, empty notions, human conventions. And then the doctrine of non-causality, we have this one in Sutta 76, paragraph 13. This holds that there is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause or condition. There is no cause or condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause or condition. This turns out to be a doctrine of fatalism. All beings are, their destiny is determined by fate, and so beings have no power to change their destiny. If I'm destined to be a stupid fool, I can't improve myself by study, by meditation. If I'm destined to be a cheating rogue, no point in trying to undertake precepts. It's just my destiny to be a deceptive rogue. If I'm destined to be a wise, a sage, or a saint, then that's my destiny. It's not really due to any effort on my part, but it's just my good fortune. And so the Buddha says, even teachers who hold those very blameworthy doctrines, they would not think of rejecting this discourse. Not because they would accept it on principle, but because they would be afraid of being blamed, criticized, and attacked by others. Okay, that is the end of the discourse on the Great 40. If there's any questions, please feel welcome to us. Yeah, so insight into, let's say, the selfless nature of things, it doesn't come immediately, but one has to arrive at it through systematic training, through the cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness. And don't give up hope, because the next sutta on our agenda is the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which doesn't actually mention impermanence. It doesn't mention the three characteristics explicitly, but it shows the method to realize the three characteristics. So let us say that our perceptual faculties are so designed that naturally we see things as being substantial. And also, selflessness or emptiness doesn't deny the existence of phenomena. This is maybe a misunderstanding. One thinks that if one sees selflessness or the empty nature of phenomena, that one doesn't see phenomena there anymore. But it's when one sees very deeply through, I use the expression at the microscopic level, the arising and passing away of phenomena from moment to moment, from moment to moment, that one sees that phenomena arise and immediately break up and pass away to be succeeded by new occasions of phenomena, one after another, after another, after another, that one then understands that the apparently solid, lasting objects of ordinary sense perception are just, we call them, chains of momentary phenomena, which are arising and passing so quickly that we can't, with our ordinary faculties of perception, we cannot perceive that change. But when the mind is trained through mindful attention, continuously over an extended period, the mindfulness built up a momentum so that one could just focus it upon any aspect of one's experience, and it's just sort of like zooming into it with a high-powered microscope. And one can observe the continual change, and especially the constant breaking up and dissolution of phenomena. And that is what discloses the selfless nature of these phenomena. So Okay, any further questions, please, or comments? Then next time we will start with the Satipatthana Sutta, that's Sutta number 10. Okay, let us do the sharing of the merit. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva nagamahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mantaram. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punyasampadam. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam. Sabbe sattha anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.